And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are Samantha Dunn and Rachel Resnick. And before we go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Irvine Regents. My first guest is Samantha Dunn, and she'll actually be on for the whole show, but we have a couple of different books we're focusing on here. Let me introduce her, and we'll start talking about the first book. Samantha Dunn is the author of Failing Paris, the Toby Press. It was a finalist for the Penn West Fiction Award in 2000, and the memoir, Not by Accident, Reconstructing a Careless Life, published by Henry Holt and Company. Her work has appeared in numerous national publications, including the LA Times, O Magazine, and Ms. And her most recent memoir is Faith in Carlos Gomez, and it's also published by Henry Holt and Company. The second half of the show, we will continue to have Samantha with us, and we'll bring on Rachel Resnick and talk about the anthology Women on the Edge, published by Toby Press. Hi, Samantha.
Hello, Barbara. How are you?
Great, and great to have you on the show. I have to tell you that I saw Faith in Carlos Gomez in a Barnes & Noble somewhere around here, probably Irvine Spectrum, and I just saw the cover. I don't remember what section of the bookstore it was in, but it just sort of jumped out at me.
Oh, good.
And and then I saw you speak at the West Hollywood Book Fair. It reminds me of the LA Times Book Festival. But and then you just seemed, it would just be so perfect to have you on the show. And so I got a hold of your book, and then of course we got in touch, and I love this memoir.
Thank you so much.
It's what a great book. Will you talk about how it came about?
Well, you know, I wish I could make up an exciting story that would inspire all of those memoirists out there who have their novel, or rather their manuscripts ready to send off. But this is what happened. I was actually pitching another book to my editor in New York. A friend of mine, actually, who I write about in the memoir, her name is, well, Julianne Ortali, my co-editor of Women on the Edge.
Mm-hmm.
And she's referred to as Jay in the book. And she loved to tango dance. And, of course, I got, you know, I was bitten by the salsa bug. And we had this idea that we would do an anthology of writers writing about dance. And so I go to, you know, I'm in New York every year, and I go and speaking to my editor, and I'm pitching her this idea, and she starts asking me about my salsa lessons, and I start telling her some, well, what I think are very amusing anecdotes about my salsa teacher. And she said, "Have you written anything?" And I said, "Oh, you know, just a couple pages in my journal." She said, "Well, you know what, send me some stuff. Type it up and just send me a few of those conversations." So I did, thinking, of course, I'm going to get a contract to do this essay anthology. And she writes me back, and she said, "No." She said, "This is your next book." So just based on the conversations that I had written up with my salsa teacher Raul, I suddenly had to do a memoir.
Interesting.
And, yeah, and then I thought, okay, well, what is this really about, and what am I going to write about for the next year? And so it really was a book that was written as I was living it.
Mm.
So it was probably my least planned, my least constructed work, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is interesting. So, I mean, this is such a personal book. There's so many personal things in the book on the pages about you and your life during this time. Was that difficult at all, or were you at this point just, I know you had a memoir before this one.
Yeah.
Were you pretty much used to just putting your life on the page, come what may?
I have to say yes. I live by this philosophy that really the people who know me know all of this anyway, because they're in my lives, my life, and they're very involved. I mean, I have this this, what would I say, family of friends who, you know, are on the phone with me every day or, you know, I see every week. And so they know the kind of the play-by-play as things are occurring. And those people will always be in my life no matter what. And to everyone else, well, you know, the way I look at it is if, well, let me just say, my mother once gave me a placard that said, maybe the purpose of your life is to serve as a warning to others. So I think, you know, if any enjoyment or insight can come from any of my experiences, I'm more than happy to share with other people. I live by that. I mean, the people who know me, and the people I don't know, well, maybe they, you know, maybe there'll be some judgment. I don't know. I really don't care, quite frankly. But others perhaps will be moved or amused.
Yeah.
So it's worth it.
Yeah. So you had an editor, your editor from before.
Yeah.
Interested.
Jennifer Barth, great interested. Editor at Henry Holt.
And so she was interested in the book, and then what? I mean, did you outline, or did you do just sort of free writing or automatic writing, trying to figure out what the story was?
Yeah,
or did you...
basically, that's what I really don't believe, for me, okay, I know that there are a great many very successful, very wonderful writers who do things like outlines and do that kind of planning, but actually I never do. What I do is I write in a journal. I write fragments, I write parts of conversations, I write about ideas or concepts that are keeping me up at night, and I don't worry about making sense. And then after a few years, in this case a few months, I go back over what I have and look at what is coming off the page and start to then build structure that way, kind of not forcing structure first, but letting the material, letting it rise out of the material as it comes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I never, honestly, Barbara, one of the big themes in this book for me is not only about love, but it's about my relationship with my family and my mother. And I couldn't plan that. You know what I'm saying? I couldn't plan those insights. I couldn't plan that. It just arose out of the experience itself.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, yeah. It works for me. I always liken it to building a quilt. You know, you get your patches of fabric, and you collect things that look attractive to you, and then you lay it out, and then you stitch it together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I try to put all my books together.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Samantha Dunn, author of Faith and Carlos Gomez. Was there ever a question of it becoming a novel?
No. Simple answer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no. I've wanted to do another novel for quite some time, but really the process for me of novel writing is it takes much longer. It's just slightly different and more laborious for me. And they, you know, my editor was specifically interested in memoir, and quite frankly, I wanted to do this as a memoir. I wanted, you know, for me, the process of writing memoir or fiction, it's the same. I mean, you go through the same work in creating beautiful sentences and creating a storyline that will compel the reader, but it's about the expectation you set up in the reader, you know. When you're saying something as a memoir, you're saying, this really did happen. It is really me, and it's really my own personal insight. And I just thought it was important to, for lack of a better expression, own it in this regard.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting for me as a reader of the books that come in for the show, and just as a reader in general, as well as being a writer, because I find that for the most part, I'm just not interested in memoir anymore.
Yeah.
And yours, though, I think what I loved about it was that it was so focused in, you know, in combining sort of dance and your personal life and your own personal sort of search for love. And, it was so focused and so, it had a narrative arc as a novel, except it was real. And you used a lot of fictional techniques as well. I mean,
sure.
You know, metaphor, simile, and just your writing is so alive you know, it has verve. And
I
found that interesting just in myself that, you know, I've just been tired of memoir and this sort of renewed my interest in the form and finding memoir like this.
I'm sorry to cut you off.
Go ahead.
But that really, that is a tremendous compliment. Thank you very much. And that's exactly, I mean, I have a couple ideas to throw out here. For me, you know, truly, I hate to say this, but I'm bored with memoir too, for the most part. It's as if people have forgotten they have to do the actual work of being an artist on the page, as if the life experience is enough. You know, it's never, you know, I wish I could remember who said this, but, you know, you get no credit in my book for living, okay? It's all about the art of putting it in whatever medium you're, you know, putting it into. And memoir is just as demanding an art form as fiction. And I think a lot of people, you know, really aren't doing the heavy lifting anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that. And there was something else that just went out of my head. Okay, so ask me another question.
Well, maybe you should read to us so everybody will know what we're talking about here.
Okay.
That'd be great.
I'll read you just the first little section of the book, and then if you want me to read more, tell me and I'll do that.
Okay.
This is the way it begins. All this happens in the year I learn to speak Spanish for real, the year I start to salsa dance, the year I feel my heart break, the year I sleep with a short man from Cuba. Salsa is mambo by any other name, some say, or perhaps its first cousin done up with a little hustle and disco from the 70s. But this really tells you nothing about what it becomes in your body, how it infiltrates your soul, the stuff it moves around in your head, the places it takes you, the things it makes you do. What you need to understand is that the music and the steps of the dance are living threads that weave back through the tropics, back to the Iberian Peninsula, and back still to the African continent, where echoes of these same rhythms form prayers to gods so ancient their names are not remembered. It's fair for me to say that dancing salsa is like using a Ouija board. Be careful, because through your play, you may be invoking something more powerful than you can handle. I'm warning you now because nobody warned me.
Hmm. I love that. That beginning definitely caught my interest. And I've been curious. I always ask people this, I think, that come on the show, but was that the original beginning?
Yes, actually it was. Well, not the whole thing, but the first sentence is, it's slightly edited, but the first sentence is the first sentence I wrote in my journal about my conversations with Raul, my short Cuban dance instructor. So it's often that way. Actually, with my first book, Failing Paris, as well, that book, I had been in a writing workshop with the author, Kate Braverman, for a couple years and had been working on a group of short stories that really, honestly, weren't going anywhere. And they just weren't working. I hadn't found it yet. And someone was writing a story about France, and we were workshopping it, and I said, listen, this is just not working. This is horrible, this piece. This isn't how it is, because I had lived in France, and I had very strong opinions about the French and about the actual life of Parisians. And the woman snapped at me and said, well, how is it then? And I went home that day, and I wrote this sentence, this is how it is, period. And that is still the first line of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's weird. It's always the first lines always come to me. It's those are just gimmies from God, but the rest of it, you know, it's all bricklaying, hard work.
Yeah. So this first line came to you, and you just knew.
Mm-hmm. I always just know. Yeah. Yes.
Interesting.
Yes. I don't know. Like I said, those just arrive, and then I've learned to trust that, and then go on.
What about the title? Faith and Carlos Gomez, A Memoir of Salsa, Sex, and Salvation.
Well, the title, actually, I didn't know, you know, again, I knew that I had this book that I was writing, but I didn't have a name for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried various things, and I don't even remember what I was trying. It was not working, whatever I was doing. And then my friend, Julianne, Jay in the book, we're having the conversation that I actually write about. And she's talking about, you know, this guy who might call me. And she said, I said, yeah, that's not going to work out either. No romance I'm ever involved in ever works out. And And then she said, just have faith in Carlos Gomez, sweetie. And as soon as she said faith in Carlos Gomez, I said, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Eureka. You know, that's a great phrase. So
it is.
It's Julianne who gave me that line.
Yeah, it really is. And I think, you know, I think sometimes good titles, well, like this one, Faith Carlos Gomez. These are words that you wouldn't necessarily find together, you know, or A Memoir of Salsa, Sex, and Salvation. When words kind of jumbled up together and made sense of that you wouldn't normally see in one sentence.
Yeah, I think that's the way with my novel, again, Failing Paris.
Yes.
It came about the same way. It was called something else. It was called A Trick of the Night, which was too awkward. It wasn't a good title. And then a friend of mine at the time who read the manuscript, and he said, I don't know. There's something there. It's like Paris is a test, and she's failing Paris. I said, that's it. Failing Paris. So
oh.
My friends named my book. What could I say?
Yeah. No, that's great. Now I want to read that, too. I'm a fan.
Thank you, Barbara.
Talk about recreating dialogue in a memoir. How do you do that? I mean, I know you said you were doing some stuff in a journal, but I imagine that a lot of it was recreated.
It is. My rules for recreating dialogue. Well, first of all, recreating my mother's dialogue is never difficult because it seems like we have the same conversations. You know, we've had the same conversations for the last 30 some plus years, and I know her tone, and I know the vocabulary she uses, and I remember distinctly exactly some things that she says. In fact, I've gone so far as to start tape recording my mom because she's such an amazing character. She's another give me from God. I mean, how can you not be a writer with a mother like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then with other people's dialogue, I really do. I mean, part of it comes from my background as a journalist. I was a newspaper reporter first and foremost, and have a degree in journalism. And I've always taken notes,
mm-hmm.
and I take notes. You know, whenever I hear interesting conversation or if there's something I'm writing about or I think it might be relevant, I'll, you know, jot down something in my notebook. And but there is sometimes where you just don't have anything written, but you want to convey character through dialogue, so you're put in the position of actually, you know, making it up or recreate. I never say I make it up because it's really, if I was going to make something up, it would be more poetic or something. I try to really be true to the way people speak, and my rule is I never use a word that I've never heard them use.
Mm-hmm.
I would never, for instance, I would never, well, I was just going to use an example from Raoul. I'd never use a Spanish word, you know, a Mexican Spanish word for him when I know that, you know, he's Cuban. I try to be very mindful of these things.
Sure.
And I try to keep dialogue very short, too.
Yes.
I don't have long, long passages of dialogue because it's just not possible unless you have those, you know, transcripts. And even if you have transcripts, really, when you listen to transcripts, they're not that interesting. People don't speak in a cohesive way often. It's more, you know, ideas go from A to Z to B again rather than A, B, C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because your dialogue, it so rings true, and it also isn't on the nose. You know, it is the way people speak, which is what it should be.
I try, again, I think keeping it short, you have a lot more room for error the longer you do something, so I try to keep it short. And also, too, I'm just very lucky to have people in my life that say memorable things, you know.
You are listening to Writers on Writing, and we're talking to Samantha Dunn, author of Faith and Carlos Gomez. Wonderful book. L Books is an imprint of Henry Holt.
Yes.
And what a wonderful imprint. Gosh, you know, the cover is also wonderful. Did you have anything to do with it?
I did, slightly. They came to me with this wonderful design, which is a woman kind of dancing off the cover, and she's stepping through the name Carlos Gomez. And initially, the back cover color was blue, and I said, no, sorry, that's not tropical enough. Mm-hmm. We need lime green or pink, and so they went with lime green. But mm-hmm. that's my only input yeah. into the cover. It was really a function of the designer, who did just a great job.
Talk about, we have a few minutes before we bring Rachel on.
Uh-huh.
Talk a bit about once you had a draft, do you barrel through and get a draft down before you go back to tweak and revise, or did you do a little bit of that as you went?
Yeah, I do a little bit of tweaking. Actually, what happens is this, I'll be completely honest. I rewrite the first 50 pages obsessively for about 3 months, mm-hmm. and then I realize, oh, gee, I only have 3 months more to write the entire book, and I then frantically plow through a draft. You don't eat. I actually sleep with my computer. I know that's a very strange thing, but when I'm in this, you know, mode of just banging out a first draft, I have my laptop computer. I write all day, all night, forget to shower, take my laptop to bed with me, wake up in the middle of the night, start writing again. And finally, I get a draft, and then I take a week off, go to the movies, take a shower, and then get back
a long
draft,
shower.
You know, the second revision, and then usually it's, you know, I want to say I turn in draft 2 to my editor, but really it's like draft 2.87 because
yeah.
you know.
So are you showing anybody along the way? Do you wait a while before you show readers?
No, actually part of what keeps me on track is that I'm a horrible procrastinator. I mean, really, I need a 12-step program for this. It's bad. And so I have in my life very wonderful friends who are writers, well, like Rachel Resnick
mm-hmm.
and Julianne Artale, my co-editor, and Janet Fitch, and a variety of other really close friends. And so I send them paid. They give me deadlines. They say, okay, I want to have 5 pages by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm in some ways, that's why Carlos Gomez has the specific tone that it has, because I was literally writing to my friend every day because I had to have the pages done.
Yeah.
And it gave it this profluence, and it gave it also this intimate tone, because I was writing to this daily deadline.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, it helps keep me. I mean, they don't actually edit.
Mm-hmm.
They might give me a note here or there, but they don't actually edit. It's just the thought that I have to have something done by the end of the day.
Yes.
I have to do all of the, I have to fool myself. I have to create these tricks to put myself on deadline, so I'll overcome my procrastination.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, it worked.
Thank you. I can breathe deep now.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we should have Rachel Resnick with us. So all of you out there, we've been talking with Samantha Dunn, author of Faith, and Carlos Gomez, published by OWL, which is an imprint of Henry Holt. So stay with us when we come back. Samantha will be with us still, and Rachel will hopefully be here too, and we'll be talking about Women on the Edge, an anthology writing from Los Angeles. So please stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Thank you. little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are still broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here with Samantha Dunn. And in a second, we're going to bring on Rachel Resnick. But first, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. I also want to remind you that I am now archiving the show on my website, which is penonfire.com. You go to the homepage, click on the radio tower, and that will bring you to the radio page. There's a few shows on there. We're getting more up all the time. We're also podcasting now on iTunes. You just have to search for Writers on Writing, and it should come up. So this show will go on at some point soon, I hope. Until then, you just hopefully you'll be here through the hour and have the pleasure of staying with my guests and me till 6. We've been here with Samantha Dunn, who is author of Faith in Carlos Gomez, a memoir of salsa, sex, and salvation, published by Owl Books, which is an imprint of Henry Holt. She is also co-editor of Women on the Edge, writing from Los Angeles, and she co-edited that book with Julianne Ortali. We're bringing on Rachel Resnick, who is a contributor in the book. She's also author of Go West, Young, Effed Up Chick, a novel of separation, St. Martin's Press. Her work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Black Book, Tin House, The Best American Erotica, 2004, The Dictionary of Failed Relationships, Swink, and Black Clock, among others. And her forthcoming pulp novel, Swivel Lips, will be published by Tin House Books, New Sin House Line, in the fall of 2006. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hey.
Good. You're both there. Excellent.
We are.
It worked. let's talk about Women on the Edge, writing from Los Angeles. And maybe to begin with, Samantha, you could talk about how this anthology came about.
Well, Toby Press is the publisher of my first novel, Failing Paris. And for some time, they've asked me to do other work. But I don't have any fiction at the moment that that's ready. And finally, the publisher said, "Well, you know, would you be interested in doing a short fiction anthology?" And I immediately said, "Yes. Can I publish some people I know?" And he said, "Absolutely, if they're good." And I said, "Absolutely, they are." And then got on the phone to my co-editor, Julianne. And I said, we have this tremendous opportunity to put together a collection of writers that might not actually be getting the due that they deserve, and some other writers that we're just fans of and we just love. And that's how it started.
How wonderful to have a press come to you asking for fiction.
Yes, it's really, I have to say, really, the Toby Press is wonderful that way. They really are one of those small literary presses that believe in just that literature, mm-hmm. literary writing, and they stand behind it. They're just wonderful. You know, so there are, you know, take heart writers out there. There are a few presses that really do care about good writing and writers.
And also that you didn't have to then begin with a proposal and get the sample chapters, beg your friends and people to...
Really, I was very fortunate. Although we didn't have that much time to put it together, they wanted it for this lineup. And so, we had to call in a few markers mm-hmm. to get some good material for basically no money and no time. So, and Rachel was one of those markers that I called in.
Mm-hmm. So then talk about, you know, putting the thing together and getting the pieces and, coming up with a theme and with along with the theme, how does that work then? Did you Rachel, did Samantha come to you and say, you know, this is going to be called Women on the Edge and it's fiction and write this kind of story, or how'd that go?
Well, the title alone was enough to, you know, straighten your spine.
Mm-hmm.
And made it clear what she was looking for. So that was really exciting because it was an opportunity to publish things that you maybe you wouldn't get a chance to ordinarily, and plus having, you know, this collection of people that Sam knew mm-hmm. was really exhilarating, too, because I think that's such a strong aspect of Los Angeles writing, that there is this generosity, and Sam is one of those people who has it, and brought people on board and also gave us all permission to unleash.
mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, with a title like that, anything goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's what we hoped.
Yeah.
Really, I do think that in Los Angeles, there is this quality to the short fiction that I see, because really, you know, people generally here, this is speaking broadly, of course, but people generally are interested in screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And so those of us who are writing short fiction or literary memoir, and not necessarily in the Hollywood mix, we're doing it strictly because we love it. There's no other reason.
Yeah.
And so there is this, and there is, too, this quality that, you know, no one's looking. And so we are saying things and writing things that might not be in vogue or might not be popular or whatever. You know, it's just, I hate to use this term, but I can't think of anything else, outsider quality that makes it really appealing.
Mm-hmm.
Outlaw, there's that's back to the boundaries and the edge, too. In fiction, there's a freedom of form and content that people are kind of hamstrung by Hollywood, seems like, right now, even the indies.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You know, I mean, I love that more and more writers are sort of, you know, what am I trying to say, are in the mainstream from California, whereas, you know, however edgy or risky their work is, whereas, you know, not too many years ago, I think the publishing industry looked at California as not being serious, so, you know.
I have a little story about that, actually. I think that's true. I think California writers are increasingly part of, how do I say, the mainstream of publishing. But there's also, too, and I experience it every time I go to New York. I go to New York a lot. And this year, there was just a real doozy. I was on my book tour. I read from Carlos Gomez. People are in line to have their book signed. A woman comes up to me, and she puts Failing Paris in front of me. And she said, in a very thick New York voice, says, I hope you don't mind if I buy this one. I said, no, you know, I'm grateful for any sale I make. And then she said, well, you know, it's just that I like what you read and everything, but I don't think I could stomach a whole book set in Los Angeles.
That is so
odd.
Only.
And then she looked at me, she said, no offense. I said, oh, please.
Oh, dear.
But I don't think you'd ever hear that in L.A., by the way.
Yeah, I don't think you would.
I don't think you'd ever. We'd never even think about it. But, yeah, there's definitely, I don't know. I don't know, Rachel, if you experience this, but when I go to New York, there's definitely like that attitude of, whoa, you're pretty good from California.
Yeah, no, there definitely is, but I think when we had a panel at one of our readings.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was Michelle Latulé said, who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares what New York thinks? The fun of writing out here is you're kind of going against the grain of Hollywood, and you're also not paying any attention to New York. You're just kind of, you know, it is the West.
Right.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Samantha Dunn, co-editor of Women on the Edge, and also talking with Rachel Resnick, who is a contributor in the anthology and an author and fiction writer. I'd love to hear both of you read from your pieces. Who would like to go first?
Rachel,
come on.
I defer.
Please.
Come on, Rachel.
No, I'm saying no. If you want me to read first, I will absolutely.
Okay, yes.
Yes, absolutely. Go.
I'm just going to read the first I would say paragraph, it's actually one sentence. Horrifyingly, it's two pages.
I love that.
It takes about 3 minutes.
Sounds
and
great.
This is from a story called Meat Eaters of Marrakesh.
Okay.
When I reach for Frank's hand and that hand is not there, is instead tucked inside one of his hidden Willis and Geiger Poplin Adventure coat pockets, fingering some of his stash, habitually plying for wetness, I can hear the stiff crackling of plastic between notes from the Cobra Charmer's flute, the crinkle of foil or coarse paper, the muted come-hither rustle of pill against pill, tablet upon tablet, moist crumbling of dung-style opium, the promise of oblivion, an answer need, not mine, not mine to answer. When the press of bodies all around us becomes a breath-skin constrictor, the desires to squeeze the very fluids from our viscera, I feel a jerk at my elbow, hear a gargled voice, a hiss, but say nothing, not even when a low cry escapes Frank as he sinks, glorious defeat of the all-too-familiar body which torments as it pleasures. I believe I can even hear the proud steroidal muscles sigh as, bunching down, they hit the dust of Marrakesh. And Frank's cry is immediately swallowed by more hissing and the distant drumbeats of leprous tribesmen, stomps and claps of midget acrobats as they form human pyramids to jeer in their own unintelligible clicking language and good price chanted by small women no older than 12 with eyes of dust who weave carpets until their fingers and eyes leak blood. And I, rejoicing, watch all this dissipate in the twisted columns of oily smoke from the food stalls where earlier Frank ate a plate of lamb brain, sopping it up with a torn crust of bread, his mouth transformed into maggotry, into a portal of decay and insatiability. Is it any wonder that I now turn and grind my foot into Frank's hand until I hear the concertina of cracking bone before I reach down to help him up with great delicacy of gesture and intention, only to bury my fists in his eye sockets once he is standing, then digging further into the cranial playroom itself, there to cop a feel of his beloved addict's brain, one little affectionate squeeze, knowing nothing except that we are everything and nothing together, and I am damned to the bone, my anxious pelvis a shark's gaping jawbone, eternally and with all due disdain, because I cannot erase the vision of two bodies rising, hers and his and his, always his and someone's, falling, nor fathom the way I want to think of them in the Casbah, the way I want to smell each and every smell, from cured goatskin to sewage, from almond soap scum to yeasty orgasmic juices, see each item in the ritual room as it held its fetid breath for the ancient spectacle of the oldest duet. I want to hear the stupid things they whispered, how their bodies slapped and sucked away the two-time sweat, the way the world's clock cracked its 60 knuckles against their 1-2 skin and beat mine a shiny purple while I slept in cretinous innocence in the Hotel Amelie around the corner. I confess, I am perversely mesmerized by their beasting need, the enormous banality of betrayal, and must play it back again and again until it becomes pornography and me, the fecal eye, the ch-
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, that is so interesting, it being all one sentence. Because it's so funny, because in my classes, I give my students, I get them writing, and when I tell them to write all one sentence and not to stop until they hear the buzzer go off, initially they look at me like, huh? What are you talking about? It's like, yeah, let it pick you up and take you with it.
That's exactly what this sentence does. It's so true.
Interesting. Was this story written specifically for this, and how did you get to it? How did it come to you?
You know, because I think Sam and Julianne were rushed to pull it together, they also gave us permission to bring stories that had been published elsewhere and to republish, which is a real treat to do, because this is a story that I had really, for myself, just stylistically and material-wise, it was scary to do, and I put myself on a limb. I had editors say, would you please chop this sentence up, for God's sake? What are you doing?
Really?
But I did find, this is always the case, where people have, it's not a science.
Yes.
Writing.
Right.
Everyone's got different takes. You got to have faith that it worked for what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And it was published before in small journals, Chelsea, which is a very cool New York Lit Mag, and Barcelona Review.
Mm-hmm.
But those don't have huge circulation, so this was a huge treat to get to not only have it printed again, but to have the unerring eye of both Julian and Sam help me edit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they let me keep my sentence.
They sure did. Many other things, too.
I know.
How did you, I'm curious how you arrange the stories in this anthology, Sam?
By pure feeling. Rachel just said it's not a science, this thing, and certainly the way we put it together was truly by mood and by feeling. What we did, what Julianne and I did, after we had all the stories that we knew we were going to use, she made a list and I made a list of what order we thought it would be in, and we were exactly together except for two stories at the end. We flip-flopped the two stories, but it just seemed that one seemed to flow into the other. There was something about one story that suggested the next and the next. And the reason we led with Karen's story was because, it's just a phenomenal piece, and it just seemed to really set the tone. And actually, it was one of the stories that I had in my head when I said yes to the Toby Press.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of these stories, you're in workshops and you have, you have friends and we trade stories around, and there are some stories in here that have never been published, and this was one of them. And I had seen this story in workshop years ago and I'd always loved it, and it had been passed up by a few literary magazines, and so she just kind of put it in the drawer.
Mm-hmm.
And when, he asked me to do that, I thought, God, this is a perfect opportunity to get something like Karen Horn's story just in print.
Yes.
So there you go. That's how it was put together.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM, and we're with Samantha Dunn and Rachel Resnick from Women on the Edge, writing from Los Angeles, and we have a few minutes left. Sam, will you read to us from your story?
Sure.
Going Green.
I'll read to you from Going Green. This is just the first, here we go. Chili Queen has decided which day she will leave. It will not be Thursday. Thursday, the guys from General Electric will be through town on their way to the Carlsbad Caverns. They pretend their mission is secret, but Chili Queen doesn't need a Geiger counter to sense their radiation. Of course they're digging salt caves in the desert. Of course they plan to seal nuclear waste there and steel drums and barrels that can also hold diesel oil. As if she cannot smell the salt dusting, the thinning hair on their fat heads, as if she cannot tell the difference in the sulfurous burning of their blue eyes. Still, they always tip equal to tab. She has considered the odds. Their money could be contaminated with that indelible print of radiation, but she takes the risk. It'll be worth it. After they finish their lunch, they tell her they'll see her next week, as if they believe she regulates her calendar by them. Chili Queen then evaluates the vinyl on the chairs they rub their body into and the spoons they use to shovel in caldo and chalupas. Inevitably, she senses an inappropriate luminescence in these items. On Thursday, the one called Mike will say to her, "Hiya, Rosarita. Change your mind about going out with me?" He will again remind her of why he calls her Rosarita. He will explain that she looks like the Mexican senorita on the plastic label of the tortillas he buys at Safeway. Queen will not smile, but he will laugh anyway, as if he's just invented something new and invigorating. She will look straight at the point on the bridge of his nose, and she will recognize him as the face of an otherwise nameless plague. So there you go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You talked about the woman who came up to you in New York for, faith in Carlos Gomez with that sort of reaction.
Yes.
What sort of reactions have you been getting to the anthology?
Oh, it's been amazing. It has been truly more than I think any of us anticipated. First, there was a very wonderful article in the Los Angeles Times calendar section a few weeks ago by Anne-Marie O'Connor. And just our readings have been filled with interested people who are just excited that there's this collection out there. I don't know exactly what it's tapped into, but it's tapped into something. I don't know. Rach, do you have any ideas?
Well, I just want to mention one woman who came up when we did a reading over at Beyond Baroque, who said not only was she moved and impressed with the readings and the work, but she was extremely taken by the bond that she sensed between all of the women who were included.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was quite interesting.
Now, was everyone familiar with each other before they,
no.
Before this came out?
No. Some of us knew, I knew a good number of the writers, but there were a few that I was just fans of. Amy Bender, for one.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know Carol Musky Dukes. I still really don't know Carol that well, but, just people that we were fans of. And then there were others that I think, I just asked friends for recommendations of people they knew who had great stories that maybe hadn't been published, and that's how a few other people came to us. But really, it was a word of mouth collection. I have to say.
Interesting. And I hear that anthologies, and it just seems like I'm seeing more and more anthologies, and hearing that they're quite the thing right now.
Yeah, seems to be.
It seems to be.
The response has been really more than I ever anticipated.
This is wonderful. And tonight you're going to be at Vroman's?
No, we were at Vroman's.
Was that last week?
Last week.
Okay.
But if you want to go to Vroman's tonight, I know that we have some coffee left.
Do you have any appearances coming up down here?
We don't yet, but we're working on one in Long Beach that should be a lot of fun.
Okay. And I would imagine that folks listening can find it listed probably in the LA Times Book Review on a Sunday.
Absolutely.
When it happens, yeah, that'd be great. Great for people to come out. I remember seeing you both with some of your writers at the West Hollywood Book Fair in beginning of October. And
yes.
And what you say, that bond, it really seemed so apparent with the writers who were there. It was just it seemed as if everyone had been very familiar with each other and working together, and it was wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Very compelling.
For those of us who weren't friends before, we've become friends now, which is always great.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if either of you or both of you actually could offer any words of wisdom for the writers who are listening.
Rachel?
Well, you know what? I didn't really answer, and this may fit in with that. I was talking about permission, because
yes.
I feel like locating your own truth, whatever, that always sounds so heavy-handed, but, just being free and liberated to explore what kind of mood or story you feel like writing, even if it's scary or disturbing to you or other people, I found I've gotten permission from fellow writers, which is one reason why I think you sense a bond, whether we know each other or not.
Mm.
There just seems to be a cross-current of support
mm-hmm.
that's very warm and not competitive.
Yes.
But similarly, I got permission from other writers in exploring the kind of story I wrote in Meat Eaters of Marrakesh. At the time, I had traveled in Morocco and taken tons of notes. I'm always inspired by travel. And I also had been reading some books. One was Mal de Roure by Comte de Lautremont, which is dark.
Mm-hmm.
And also some Ingeborg Bachmann, who was suggested to me by Michael Silverblatt. And as well as getting permission from seeing what other people write. I mean, you see, Sam's writing in Julianne's surrealistic tale of a 60-year-old woman who starts lactating. Dylan Landis's just searing story about this kind of cusp of womanhood and awakening. And the Debbie Land, that really mm-hmm. scary Amy Bender story that just kind of exposes the cruelty of children.
Mm-hmm.
All of this kind of conspires to give an encouragement or permission. So I would say seek out writers who are living and also on the page who help you explore what you feel like exploring.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Ditto.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you both for taking the time to come on the show. And, just great work, and I look forward to seeing more by both of you.
Thank you, Barbara.
We
thank
promise.
You for the invitation.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah.
That was Rachel Resnick and Samantha Dunn talking to us from Los Angeles, and Women on the Edge is the anthology with both of them in it and co-edited by Samantha Dunn. And Faith and Carlos Gomez is Samantha's memoir that we spoke about during the first half. And, gee, we're at the end of another show. And what can I say? I can say if you want to know more about the show, you can go to my website at penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower. It'll take you to the radio page and tell you more. And there, as I said earlier, you can listen to archive shows. You can also go to iTunes and pick up the podcast. There are a few on there at this point. I know there's much more, but right now I am just going to say ta-ta and leave you with a quote by Catherine Drinker Bowen, who said, "Writing is a kind of double living. The writer experiences everything twice, once in reality and once in that mirror, which waits always before or behind." Yeah. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And come back next week. We'll have David Yulin, the new editor of the LA Times Book Review, and Dr. Mark Siegel, author of False Alarm. Stay tuned to Between the Lines.